You know, if you're a mercenary or a contract worker today in Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere, the U.S. government will probably disavow the fact that you are there. Even though you may be being paid by a branch of our government, you certainly will not get all the intelligence that you probably need or all the resupply that you probably need. So you're going to live off the land, you're going to know the enemy, and you're going to try to survive. And in that process, you get to do things that our normal armed forces, if they get caught, are going to pay for.
Well, can you give me some examples of this? What a mercenary can do that a normal enlisted soldier is not supposed to do?
Well, I guess the news of the day would certainly be the interrogation process. We as a society have, you know, double standards. If you say, I will grab prison, and that we, you know, we just going to put them.
Mercenary of death, you killer for hire in a world for sale. Shut up. You got the nerve to talk about how you and your raggedy government, Sam, will disavow what you hooligans are doing in the name of maintaining the order. But at the same time, a branch will be paying you, basically the corporate branch. And you go on to about how this is all more or less in the good fight against the enemy. But who defines who's the enemy for you, savage? Your corporate masters, the ruling order, the hierarchical structure, the disaster capitalists, the arms capitalists, the resource management energy capitalists, big oil, natural gas conglomerates, etc. In other words, you're just a plantation monkey with a machine gun. It's time that us slaves unite and light your lights on fire. You know what the hell time it is. Slave time, Jenny. FreakRadio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1, 106.7, 96.3, LQVER.com, the world, RadioForAll.net, the universe. Click into the slave web, slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com, and two other slave and resistance sites, propagandapress.org and savagejustice.blogspot.com. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to deal with the soullessness that exists within the American Empire. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe, 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 believe,
we'll be right back.
red, white, and blue American public are people without a soul of their own. A population lost in the consumerist, privatized, Abrahamic wilderness, looking for something to give them meaning in their lives, a sense of purpose, some direction, a vision of destiny. The U.S. imperial killing machine apparatus provides the illusion in many ways of that righteous sense of purpose. In this Ruins of Empire segment called The Lost Souls of a Militarized Empire, we're going to explore this on Slave tonight, this particular phenomenon, step by step. First, let's start off with Kobe Bazell, a 26-year-old when he enlisted, who was going from one jive time plantation job on Sam's plantation to another, living at home, no real sense of direction. And then one day, Kobe volunteered to be a G.I. Joe and go off and kill human beings he never met in Iraq. He started his own blog called My War. But does he even know if it's his war or not? We're going to explore some of these things. But first, let's start off with how Kobe, who was smoking a lot of dope before he enlisted, told the recruiting agent this. And it was posed that he may have trouble passing. But to no avail, Kobe, the soon-to-be machine gunner of Iraqis, was told how he could more or less hurdle over this particular loophole in the name of empire. Check it out.
I really, because my recruiter helped me out with that one. I totally forgot about
it. Are they allowed to do that?
I don't know if they're allowed, but, you know, it got me in and it worked. I went in and next thing you know, he's like, you know, have you ever done drugs? And I was like, oh my God, you know, do you want me to answer this honestly kind of thing? And he pulled me up to the side, to the back, and next thing you know, he pulled out this homemade kit, like a homemade drug test kit, and the results weren't that great, and he told me he would get me a drink to take the night before the drug test, along with a gallon of water. And he said the drink or the solution was expensive, but he would give it to me if I signed up, and he did, and I did everything he told me to do, and I passed the test and got in the Army.
Now, what's kind of interesting about this starting off is that this is a country that loves to play on the righteousness, following the rules, obeying the laws. Right now, they're still acting hysterical over a bunch of baseball players and the steroid episode. They won't let off Barry Bonds and his whole steroids. They often throw in him being a bad influence, even though you can go to any bookstore, look into the magazine section, and see all these muscle-bound magazine guys and gals all loaded out on roids. As a matter of fact, many high schools have even reported that a large number of the students who actually use steroids aren't even athletes. They're just obsessed with quote-unquote looking good, so they're trying to chisel their physique. And, you know, kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And one of the ways that many try to do this is by the use of steroids. Now, when it comes to issues like some little athlete, you know, that type of stuff, then there's all this righteous indignation. There's no tolerance whatsoever about these types. The whole war on drugs is predicated on, quote-unquote, making the streets safer and all of that type of stuff. Of course, we all know it has a particular agenda. Now, concerning letting druggies in to the army, well, once again, there's a look the other way. Now, we all know these drug laws are bogus. And drugs against marijuana is political, just like everything else. But this helps highlight, which is the purpose of me mentioning this, is that they don't really care about the laws. It's what can best serve their interests. So Kobe, yeah, he smokes a little, but that's all right. We have a way around it. So even though we have the pretext with these laws that say you're not supposed to do it, if you're willing to play our game, then we'll find a loophole. We'll strategize a loophole for you. It's the same way they look the other way with these roided out punk cops on the streets. You know, they're all roided out trying to look hard. They actually brag on some of these roid websites, which there are hundreds of, and talk about what cycles they use and all of that, what neighborhoods they patrol and all of that type of stuff. Now, a number of these types of punks have been involved in all kinds of crazed shootings, because often they're not just roiding out. They're just doing all types of stuff, too, cocaine and all of that. But it's been a brick wall that many people who've tried to go the quote-unquote legal route to get drug testing amongst many of these cops for particular types of drugs like steroids. So the Miami River Boys or Justin Velopi or whatever can be down with the roid program all they want. Justin Velopi is one of the cops who tortured Abner Louima in the bathroom in New York. That's all good as long as you're fighting, or killing, I should say, for empire. Now let's move on as Bozell talks about whether he thinks the imperial war waged by Sam is a good thing and the politics behind all of U.S. adventures in the region. So let's check this.
I think Saddam is a threat. I think we did a lot of good getting him out of there. You know, when I was over there, a lot of the Iraqis that I spoke to told me that, it was pretty bad when he was in charge. So I'm glad that we got him out of there. But politics and all that stuff, I don't really think too much about it. I don't know. I don't really know that much about it.
That's pretty sad. He is a grown man, and he doesn't even know what he's going and fighting and killing for. Doesn't even know. And on a certain level, doesn't even care that he doesn't know. He just wants to play his role to put some meaning into his meaningless and soulless life. Not question, why does his life feel meaningless? Why does he feel left without a soul? But instead, he wants to find soul within the machine, or some sense of purpose, and thereby go off and kill at command some people he's never even had a contact with. That's someone who's lost his mind. That's someone who, has no soul. He talked about, I think Saddam was a threat. Well, how do you define that, Kobe? To who? Who was he a threat to? Who defines what a threat is? On what level? Nationally, internationally, locally? Define a threat on an international level and how Saddam fits into that. Have some questions. Question some aspect of authority. Don't just be a drone, a killing machine drone. That's a fool without any sense of purpose or any sense of dignity. Then he goes into how he's not into politics and all that stuff. All that stuff? Politics? When these politics that we are talking about makes decisions on what countries get invaded and what countries don't. Whose land is occupied and whose land isn't. Who lives and who dies. That's all that stuff. Talking about, I don't think much about it. Why not? You are willing to pick up the machine gun for empire. If you're willing to go off and kill for empire, don't you think it behooves you to question that if it fits within your moral compass to do such actions? But this is how the game is played. Out. In much of a soulless society. Now here Bozell talks about the event in Iraq that stands out in his mind. Well, let's see what finally shook some brain cells into a little bit of contemplation. Dig this.
August 4th, that was the day I don't think I'll ever forget.
What happened?
That was the day, it was just like any other day. I just, you know, we were just all hanging out in our rooms, and I was reading a book, and all of a sudden, you know, we heard the faint mortar explosions on our base, and they were kind of spread apart. They weren't really close, but you can hear them on our base, and something was odd about that, because usually when we get mortared, it's like one or two mortars, and then that's it. This went on for like a good 20 minutes, and then finally my roommate stormed in the door, and he says, yeah, you know, all hell's breaking loose over Mosul, load up, the whole battalion's rolling out. And, you know, we all ran down in the motor pool, grabbed our equipment, stormed out of the base, people were shooting their weapons, you know, from the FOB, and we were driving down this road to go to this bridge where there was, from what we heard over the radio, a large concentration of anti-Iraqi forces there, and our job was to go over there and take care of them. And on the way there, they had an ambush set up for us, and you know, the vehicle in front of us got hit by four RPGs. I think every vehicle in our platoon got hit by an RPG except ours. And, you know, these people were just coming out of nowhere, shooting at us. And that was the moment when I was like, okay, this is it. This is my last day on Earth. You know, I was lucky to make it.
Did that change how you felt being in Iraq?
Yeah, it kind of did, because it's like if I didn't make it, like, I don't know, sort of what's the point kind of thing.
Like, why did I do this in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, that's when the regret hit you. You know, like, this was a stupid idea, you know. But, yeah, it kind of changed me too. You know, there's nothing glamorous or glorious about going over to another country and fighting a war. It's all that's just, once you've experienced something like that, you know, there's nothing glamorous about it at all, like how you see in the movies and stuff.
Then why are you proud you went on to this war on behalf of your imperial masters? If you had questioned some of this stuff before you went into the damn recruiting office, maybe you would not have been an assistant in the death of innocent people in Iraq. A machine gunner for Empire. A person without a soul, without any kind of true human judgmental foundation of human principles of your own. It's that of the orders. Of course, there's nothing glamorous about slaughtering an occupied people. You know, Frederick Douglass, when he talked about the violence that he engaged in with his Negro breaker, you know, Covey, when Frederick Douglass was sent, you know, when he was in his teens, to Covey, the Negro breaker, basically to break black kids' soul so that they will be broken commodities for the ruthless exploitation of the flesh peddlers. Frederick realized at a certain point that there was no getting around this barbaric treatment by Covey, and he had to physically resist, or he would just be physically broken down into a drone on the plantation system. He ended up physically whipping up Covey. And Frederick talks about this afterwards when he says, quote, "This battle with Mr. Covey was the turning point in my career as a slave. It rekindled the few expiring embers of freedom and received within me a sense of my own manhood. It recalled the departed self-confidence and inspired me again with a determination to be free. The gratification afforded by the triumph was a full compensation for whatever else might follow, even death itself. He only can understand the deep satisfaction which I experience, who has himself repelled by force the bloody arm of slavery. I felt as I had never felt before. It was a glorious resurrection from the tomb of slavery to the heaven of freedom. My long crushed spirit rose, cowardness departed, bold defiance took its place, and I now resolved that however long I might remain a slave in form, the day had passed forever when I could be a slave in fact. I did not hesitate to let it be known of me that the white man who expected and succeeded in whipping must also succeed in killing me. From this time, I was never again what might be called fairly whipped. Though I remained a slave 4 years afterwards, I had several fights, but was never whipped. Now, the reason why, in part, I point this out is that for the slaves, there is a form of necessary violence. But that violence is an expression not so much of anger, but of the desire to be free. A desire to relinquish oneself from the shackles of a barbaric institution that has no human respect for the slaves. Frederick was not about to be a spoke in the wheel for machinery of destruction. So you can see one person using resistance to ascertain, maintain, and resubmit his soul, and another, Bozell, floundering and being basically a vehicle of more repression throughout the planet for a soulless empire. Now here Bozell talks about what his fellow G.I. Joe's dad told him about how to deal with his war experience and memories. So let's see what a fellow G.I. Joe had to say to Bozell about this.
That was the day after right after the ambush. We went back to the base and we were all loaded up and ready to go back out. And I wasn't really in the mood to going back out, especially since it was nighttime, and that's like really scary because you really don't know what's going on, and that's the confusion. And my friend Sergeant Vance saw me sitting by myself and came over and sat next to me, and you know, me and him talked about what was going on. I told him my fears. And his dad was in Vietnam, and he said, you know, the advice he gave him for situations like this was to put all the events, you know, put everything that bothers you and clogs your head up at night, put it in a shoebox, put a lid on it, and deal with it later. You know, you've got a job to do, just deal with it later. And, looking back, that's kind of what I did with the whole war. I mean, and it's all kind of in a shoebox kind of for me.
Once again, this is just playing into a hierarchical institution and script laid out. Deal with it later. What if the mission you are on is a mission of death for the masses? What if it's unprincipled at the core? Now you have a situation where if all you're going to do is shoebox essential questions a true living human being with a sense of purpose and a soul should be asking, then what good are you for humanity? What is this? These are people who've been droned out to take commands, not to really question authority, play by the rules. You got a job to do. So don't question what the job is really entailing, what it really means, what it will even mean for future generations, possibly your own kids. Just bow your head down and do it. Now, after you've already done it, we already know how large portions of the population and the institutions don't really want to hear it. You're disposable. They don't care what you have to say once you get back. Hell, they fed you guys in Nam all kinds of Agent Orange and didn't care before you got back how you would hold up. The Persian Gulf War clique are full to the rim and brim with Gulf War syndrome. Now they're feeding another generation full of depleted uranium along with the Iraqi population. It means nothing. Are you going to shoebox that? But this is what happens when you've been conditioned to be a drone, a soulless drone for empire. Now here Bozell describes how after he came back to Sam's plantation, how he felt that the only thing he was good for was basically data entry and machine gunning for the order. Let's listen in.
That's how I felt on the plane ride home. It was like, you know, now what? It was like the same feeling kind of when I graduated high school on that last day. It's like, okay, I'm excited that I graduated high school, but now what the heck am I going to do? I felt kind of the same way when I was coming home from Iraq. You know, I wasn't re-enlisting. You know, and the only option I had was to maybe go to junior college. And even at junior college, I mean, nothing really there really interests me. So it's like you have this feeling of now what? And since I've been out, like, talking to the other guys that got out of the Army the same time as I did, a lot of them are having, like, an extremely hard time finding jobs. Some of them are claiming unemployment still. Some of them are still running around trying to find jobs. And some of them that have found jobs found security jobs, making, like, $9, $10 an hour. And since they're new, they get the graveyard shift. And they're, you know, they're telling me that that's the only jobs that they can find since they've been back. And some of them re-enlisted, went back, and joined. And, you know, some of them don't know what to do next. You know, that's kind of, you know, I mean, I'm kind of experiencing that right now. I mean, I wrote a book, you know, but now it's like, now what?
Is this what you expected?
Yeah, I totally expected this. Yeah, honestly, yeah, I expected this the whole time, that nothing would really maybe change, but, you know, I can say I did something.
Then what the hell did you go for? You didn't expect any change, any fundamental change in your life, but you just went off to this place where you easily could have gotten killed or maimed. But the plantation that you come back to, and that the empire that you served, you knew that they would have nothing in the real to offer you. And place no demands on it. Have no expectations. Have no idea about how to change the situation. Just come back a demoralized drone. Before you even touch bases, put your boots back on Sam's plantation, you're already confused about what to do next. That's a sad state. But that's what it means to have no soul, no sense of purpose, no real destiny outside of the corridors of empire. Because the rulers, they have a purpose. It's a diabolical purpose. But you can see their purpose. They're not building all of these bases in Iraq, just for fun. They haven't been strategizing on this global Anglo-American corporate axis for geopolitical strategic reasons with places like Turkey and Israel, Saudi Arabia,
to blast into Lebanon with eyes on Syria and Iran in the future. They're not doing that without a purpose. They're not developing a grand strategy for carving up Africa in the energy resource wars that they have going on with other privatized institutions like China and Russia and the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They have a sense of purpose. All these slobs, administrators for the order, Condoleezza Rice, on down the line, that are being spokespersons for empire. They have a sense of purpose. It's a purpose that is in complete opposition to the slave's purpose, the conscious ones, but they have a purpose. It would behoove Kobe to start asking some of these questions on what it means to be a true human being on this planet. So when he says, after all of this, he totally expected no real change and all of that, but at least he could say he did something. Did what? Fight for the imperial machine under the agenda of a genocidal dollar and chains order? That right there sums up what it means to have no soul. Now next, Carla Williams, author of the book Love My Rifle More Than You, talks about the parallel universe she's often in with fellow G.I. Joes in Iraq, where she feels a bondness towards them because they're all machine gunners under Sam's flag for empire. Yet at the same time, she and other females are treated as either bitches, quote unquote, or sluts, quote unquote. Let's check out what Carla has to say about this American experience.
An incredibly confusing and difficult and frustrating line to walk, to trust people with your life, to count on them for everything, and to be willing to give up your own life for them while at the same time having this subtle undercurrent that's kind of interfering with that bond that you form. It's difficult, and it's something you don't necessarily even want to think about or acknowledge. I certainly didn't while I was there, and even now looking back, it's really hard for me to try to figure out how to look at things. And I think a lot of the types of experiences that I had can exist on multiple levels, if that makes any sense. Guys in the army deal with each other in a strangely sexual way sometimes, the way that they joke around with each other. They'll pretend to hump each other, for example. And this isn't them sexually harassing one another. This is their strange way of bonding. So if they deal with a female soldier in that same way, are they sexually harassing the female soldier or are they accepting her? And so to kind of struggle with wondering about that and wondering what exactly is going on and how you should react, it's difficult. It's hard to know exactly how to react to things.
Now, this is clearly a person who's never looked at other people's experiences to see how they have had to try to navigate themselves within the world today. When she talks about how things work on multiple levels, and that there's things that are incredibly confusing and frustrating with the way that there's a bondness, but at the same time there's a form of sexual, deep sexual domination and violence towards women. Well, basically, it's not all that confusing and frustrating in many ways. Basically, this is just a form of patriarchal dominance. And in the same way that you have forms of racist, racial hierarchical dominance, where you can have black G.I. Joes, Negroes fighting for empire, but many of them know that many of these cats from all levels think of them as being inferior. One of the shows we did a while back was on a Haitian G.I. Joe experience. And this was a Haitian brother who, you know, thought he was going to serve for empire. And the next thing he knew, the military was treating him in all kinds of double standards, trying to push him out of the military. He takes reduced rank, goes off to Iraq to fight. When he gets back, the fact that he wasn't born in America, they throw him in court to kick him out of the country, even though he had seen and had gone through a process where they said that those who serve would have permanent U.S. Stature. And he saw another Latino cat who was going through the same thing, who went into the military under that understanding. And they talked about the fact that there was just a particular sergeant who wanted all the colored folks out the country who weren't born here. Probably the ones who were born here too, but he couldn't do much about that. But at least the ones who weren't born here, he wanted them out after they served Sam's military imperial order. So throughout the conversation on the show, you could see this guy going back from Pledge of Allegiance to Empire, but at the same time have the consciousness to know that at the end of the day, he's a black person on the imperial plantation, and different games are played out within that construct. So when she later talks about how there's certain things at times that you don't want to acknowledge, basically she's talking about there's contradictions that she doesn't want to address, like those contradictions I just pointed out. Now, of course, that means that you'll just end up slipping into, if you just keep playing that game, a form of denial. Now, the worst types of these are, you know, Negroes like Ward Connolly, who just play it out to the tilt. But they're obvious to black people that this is the skit that this buffoon's playing. But the fact that she's never questioned these types of things before, it seems like she went into the military, it just seems like she's just completely unprepared to address these issues and is confused in many ways about them now. So when she talks about these are part of the multiple levels. They're just contradictions. But when she talks about, you know, some of these guys be humping each other, or, you know, playing like they're humping each other, and if they are do that to women, is that sexual harassment or is it bonding and stuff? Well, obviously, this goes from person to person. But generally, people who are in one of the oppressed groups know that there's a fine line, and these types of lines they generally don't play because of the overall hierarchical nature within these societies that will exploit them and use them, envision them in a dehumanizing way towards you, as opposed to how they deal with it concerning someone else. This is part of the reason why historically black people didn't tolerate white people calling them nigger. Now, they'll more or less accept it in general when other black people use the term. Not all black people play that, but you know, but that has more to do with it having different meanings. Well, by the same way, a white person saying it is something where often for black people that crosses the line because of the relationship of power, the interpretation, and all the other things that play into that aspect. But see, it's clear that she's never asked these types of questions for herself. So when she talks about there's multiple levels of tolerance and intolerance and all of that, that's basically just the status quo aspect, where you have a situation where you can be a Negro G.I. Joe and be tolerated as long as you follow the status quo. It's like being in the NBA in some ways. As long as you don't talk about racial issues, as long as you don't talk about politics, as long as you bow your head to the flag while you do the national anthem, or come out and do a little speech about I support the troops, or go off and play in the Olympics or other little, you know, nationalistic enterprises for the red, white, and blue, then you'll be tolerated on a certain degree. Now, it doesn't mean that they accept black people overall. Well, look at the, L.A. Clippers owner. Here he has all these Negroes on the team. Now, on the surface, that gives the impression that, oh, see, he doesn't mind black. That's how the average surface depth person would look at it. But in reality, he's just tolerating those Negroes as long as they play the line, because this same dude and his wife have been fined once again for discriminating against black and Latino people in housing. He owns all this property throughout LA and other places and stuff, and they keep getting caught discriminating against black and Latino people, where they keep getting these hefty fines. So, yet he owns a team full of Negroes on it. So there's multiple levels, is what I'm saying. But if you don't ever question these types of issues and just look at surface depth type of thing, you can find yourself into an inflamed basket of rotting eggs and be caught totally off guard. Now here, Williams is asked about whether she feared sexual violence or was afraid of being raped by fellow G.I. Joes while she was off in Iraq. So let's check this out.
Were you ever afraid of sexual violence, afraid of being raped?
No, because, you know, I had a gun all the time. You always carry a weapon. It's pretty much a constant presence. And so, as strange as that may sound, that is definitely part of your knowledge. This knowledge that if a guy starts to cross a line, you may start to feel intimidated, but you still have a weapon.
It's interesting thinking about the position of women in the military and the way you were, because partly it seems like this very complicated dynamic of power and powerlessness. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I've gotten such an impression for so long that in America we really like to downplay the importance of power in interpersonal relationships, but it's crucially important.
I was also thinking that that's kind of a theme of power and powerlessness that comes up in your book in so many different ways, and it's maybe an awkward transition, but I wanted to ask you about some of the work you've done with Iraqi detainees.
There were two occasions that I had interactions with detainees. Once was just very brief and low-key. The day that Uday and Kuse were killed, I happened to be in Mosul, and they picked up a lot of detainees, and I assisted in some initial screenings. And one of the men who had been picked up was just very drunk and extremely belligerent and uncooperative. And another soldier and I trying to get just some basic information out of him, his name and, you know, where he was from and that sort of thing. And he was so incredibly belligerent that we ended up yelling at him quite a bit. And I was shocked to realize how, I don't know the right word, I don't want to say it wasn't exactly pleasurable, but how much of a relief it can be to just scream at someone, because it's something that we don't do. And especially, I think, for women, if you want to bring up that whole power versus powerlessness issue again, for women to get to be in total control of a man and scream at him is something that is very unusual, and I was really almost horrified to realize that it could be something that I didn't hate. It's really strange to look back on and remember it, because when you're in, you know, when I'm in a nice, clean, well-lit studio where I can get a cup of coffee and I'm not carrying a gun, it seems so very remote. But yeah, at the time, you're just so frustrated and so angry, and you've been trapped in this foreign country, and you have no way to leave or go home, and you're always in danger. You're just fed up with the fact that you're trying to help people, and they're periodically trying to kill you. It gets really frustrating. And even when you know that it's more complex than that, that's sometimes really what it feels like.
Now, this says a whole lot. When she once talked about how she didn't fear that much her safety because she had a gun all the time. Well, so much for the comrade sense. The comradely sense of purpose. Well, the only reason why you feel safe around these guys that you're supposed to be fighting the good fight against is the fact that you have a gun in your hand to defend yourself from them. See, this comes down to the fact that a male hierarchical order doesn't equal justice. After all, the U.S. military, the privatized military machine that it supports, is not an institution for human justice. It's an institution to expand domination, to penetrate and orchestrate overthrows for a particular elite order. There's nothing justifiable or humane about that. And these little G.I. Joes in this, they know it. They know what kind of institution that they're in, and that they can play out their little wet dream fantasies on people of lower rank within the existing order. Then she talks about how it was a relief to scream at someone. You know, talks about this in the context as a female. But this Iraqi man didn't do anything to you. The ones that were doing and trying to do things to you were U.S. G.I. Joe men. But if you don't question the overall reason that you're there, you're just a soul without a purpose. And then hooked into the machine of the empire, where you're just floundering out just to be cast out like a piece of bait in the ocean. And then she talks about how she's trapped in this foreign country. You took your ass down there. No one took you over there. You didn't have to go down there. That was your decision. You're not trapped in that country. You're trapped in your own soullessness. And then wrapped it up talking about how she's fed up with people periodically who that they're trying to help, who are periodically trying to kill you. Now, she says she knows it's just not that simple. You're damn right it's not that simple. Because you're the occupier. You're the force of oppression. Because you're part of the machine of belligerence, domination, and oppression. Now, here next is Richard Mancino, a former Navy salesman. He's had over 150 confirmed killings of Vietnamese people in his Nam years. Now Mancino is a killer for hire in a world for sale, a mercenary. Now let's go into how he views that the war on terror, quote unquote, has changed everything. Let's hear what this little killer mercenary has to say. Dig this.
my mind, a mercenary of the old was a social misfit that just didn't adapt after combat and stayed in that environment where he felt comfortable and didn't necessarily have to worry about beliefs and what he was there for. Today, it's really changed. It's changed because the enemy has changed. You're fighting an enemy without a flag, without a uniform, without a country. So the rules change. And so that means that today's mercenary or contract worker, whichever you would prefer to call it, is now a necessity. Because when you are a member of the United States Armed Forces, you have rules telling you, more rules to tell you what you can't do than what you can do. And of course, most of the military leadership is more politically correct than it is understanding that this is a war. So a contract worker slash mercenary, one makes that judgment a little cleaner and is in fact a survivor. You know, if you're a mercenary or a contract worker today in Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere, the U.S. government will probably disavow the fact that you were there. Even though you may be being paid by a branch of our government, you certainly will not get all the intelligence that you probably need or all the resupply that you probably need. See, you're going to live off the land, you're going to know the enemy, and you're going to try to survive. And in that process, you get to do things that our normal armed forces, if they get caught, are going to pay for.
Now it's interesting hearing this guy talk, because he's talking about how being a mercenary puts them in a position where in the past they were social outcasts and they didn't worry about their beliefs or what they were there for. But now everything has changed, when in reality being a mercenary in the past and today, or a contract worker as he likes to describe it, what are the contracts for? Who decides the contracts? Who outlines these particular contracts? Who do they get these contracts from? These contracts are from disaster capitalists, energy resource capitalists, arms capitalists, to protect their particular interests. Like in the days of old, they're just merely a patrolling guard for the order's interest. So these mercenaries that were out in New Orleans, what were they doing? They were there to protect the old line family elite's order's interest. So a Slav mercenary, which is what they are, is basically accepting and assuming that what is used and what is the program of the elite for fomenting a particular war is legit. This is how they operate. This is how they justify their particular contract situation, which is in alignment with a particular ruling order. There's no soul that these mercenaries have. They're just a beast with a machine gun. Now here, the mercenary Mancino describes what's out of bounds for the U.S. military, but not out of bounds for fellow killers for hire. So let's see what he has to say.
Well, I guess the news of the day would certainly be the interrogation process. We as a society have, you know, double standards. If you say Abu Ghraib prison and that we just court-martialed a young private for doing those things to prisoners, which in my mind was probably not much more than hazing things done at fraternity parties of old. a contract worker certainly can get to the meat of the problem and inflict discomfort. whether how's that for a play on words?
And what other people would call torture, but you say torture. I mean, that, what do you make of something like the word?
Well,
torture?
You don't torture. But what is torture? I mean, it certainly can inflict pain, but you can also do it by playing with their belief system, by playing with their mind. Now, is that torture? Well, if you're a liberal mindset, yes, it is torture. But is it maiming them? No, it's not maiming them. And the same people that would say, what are we doing before we found Saddam Hussein? Well, where is he? Why can't we find him? We put all these billions over there, and we have all these troops over there, and we still don't have him. You know, why can't you get intelligence? You know, 2 weeks later, we have Abu Ghraib prison, and we say, well, why are you doing those nasty taking pictures of prisoners that are nude and having their dogs excite them a little bit? It's like a double standard.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is if mercenaries or contract workers are basically working outside the rule of law. I mean, you're basically saying that the Geneva Convention dealing with warfare just does not apply to these people. I mean, no one's going to follow these rules. I'm assuming some bad things can happen. And I guess one question that comes up is, does this ever weigh on people's mind? I mean, do people feel guilty about some of the things they do if it turns out that they end up, killing a bunch of civilians? I mean, does that weigh on your conscience?
I haven't done anything that's weighing on my conscience. I guess that's, everybody has their own threshold and their own level of involvement that can or cannot bother. But you're normally doing jobs that nobody else wants to do in places that nobody else wants to go. A mercenary, he has to be effective, and he has to work within the rules of the land. Maybe not the government, but the rules of the land.
Now, in the clip right before, you heard the mercenary talk about mercenaries in the past were social outcast types and all of that. They didn't have to worry about beliefs and all of that type of stuff, but now it's a new day. Yet, he's talking about how he hasn't done anything that weighs on his conscience, yet he's just a contract worker. He admits he's just a mercenary, a killer for hire. And when it is a killer for hire within the confines of the U.S. Empire, you're an imperial soldier on the grand chessboard stage. Now, if that doesn't inform you that you have no real principle, then it's clear you have no soul. Then he tries to just kind of, fluff off the quote-unquote interrogation process. So here we go, it's just a word game. Torture. Torture is not real torture. It's just, a form of making someone feel somewhat uncomfortable. And there's various ways that one can do that. See, this is how you know when you're dealing with sick individuals who at the end of the day, they just have a particular agenda that they're trying to succeed in doing. And playing that part out is their main functioning goal. The human degradation, the mass murder, the unjustifiable occupation and its genocidal consequences are just incidental to them. But this is what it means to be locked within a machine that rationalizes out profit over people. That rationalizes out that some are deserving and some aren't. That privatizes out the majority of resources and wealth for the few at the expense of the many. And they have their armed machinery to reinforce that status quo. Those who play within those particular confines end up becoming pegs without souls. He wraps it up saying that a mercenary has to be effective within the rules of the land. Now, in reality, it's the rules of the land invader. Because the mere fact that you're on someone's land and that you are an invader means that you've rationalized this process out to justify why you're there at someone else's expense and destruction and all of the collateral carnage that goes along with it. Now, remember when the G.I. Joe, a while back, in Iraq, shot an incapacitated Iraqi who was sprawled out on the floor. It may have been a mosque or something they were in. It was caught on a video. Let's hear how this mercenary responds to this particular act when questioned about it.
Well, I think that's very good for Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, let's take the troop that was there, you know, that living on the ground, lousy weather, it's either too hot or too cold, no showers, lousy food, and his buddies are getting shot at, and the IEDs are going off, and basically, you know, he's pissed. He's got to, you know, get tired. And it's like Pavlov's theory. You go into a room like that, and someone goes to reach. You protect yourself and the guys that you're with, that you go back to back with. So that, you know, that's, you can say it's collateral damage, but that is war. This is not babysitting. So, I mean, those things happen. Those are judgment calls. Now, you know, we sit back here, cup of coffee in our hand, an air-conditioned space, drink, you know, and saying, well, you should have waited. Well, you know, you weren't puckered up, and the bullet didn't go past your head with your name on it, and you're not beat. You know, you had a shower last night or this morning, and you're comfortable. So it's, you got to put yourself in the environment when those things happen. I guess I can put it another way around. I have heavy combat time in Vietnam, and I don't have any Purple Hearts. I don't have any Purple Hearts because I always shot the other guy first. And my rationale was, if Congress didn't have the guts to declare the war, I'm not going to leave my guts here.
All right, basically, this is just more soulless rationalization. No, you didn't leave your guts in Vietnam, but if you had a soul, you definitely left that there. The Nam War was an imperial war. Iraq is an imperial war. The so-called war on terrorism is based in imperial objectives. These are not justifiable programs by the order. They are indecent, savage acts by a ruling order. And the mere fact that you see this clown justifying this type of stuff in his various ways lets you know his true moral fiber. Now, he gets into this Monday morning quarterback thing. You know, here you have a guy who, you know, had his buddies getting shot at, lousy food, no shower, so on and so forth. You have to put yourself into that person's situation. Now, you know you're talking to an imperialist when they never talk about the situation of the people that they're occupying. Because the people who are occupied are always dehumanized by the savage invaders. So their situation is not to be considered. The reason why they may be in revolt is not to be questioned. The reason why the slaves went into revolt on the American plantation, or in Haiti, or in Brazil, or in Baghdad against the Arab Islamic slavers, the Zanj, and on and on. That's not supposed to be questioned. Looking through the eyes of the oppressed, the occupied, the slavers, is always supposed to be ignored by the slaver. Now here, let's hear him describe his focus as a mercenary. So let's check this out.
Tupper has a makes you say, oh, are they mean or are they nasty? If I look at my young SEALs today, that, you know, so basic training is 6 months. You know, that's besides the being in the military. 6 months of SEAL training before they go to a command, and that's on probation, and then they go to the field, and they continue to learn. Well, you know, they just have gone through reportedly the hardest training that you can get, and they're young Tigers now, and they want to go test their mettle. And you send them to Afghanistan and Iraq, and if they're not turned loose, you keep them on a base because some conventional commander doesn't want to have blood count on his hands. You know, not on my watch do I want a body count. Or stay here and pick up fraud on the runway so that the planes can react, but you just can't stay there getting your weapons ready to go to war and go and just romp through the woods and kill people. Well, you know, having said that, you said you frustrate this young Turk that says, this is what I want to be, and somebody of my background and almost my age comes in out of the hills in a beat-up pickup truck and has been out there working very hard as a mercenary / contract worker and making $250,000 to $500,000 a year. Now,
you make a lot of money doing this. $250,000 to $500,000 a year is what a mercenary can bring down in Iraq.
I would say that probably 7 months on the ground, you can take in $250,000. You know, I think that a special operations guy or a mercenary kind of, they are social misfits that make music together, but they are independent thinkers. They are aggressive by nature. They are innovative, and they are focused on mission accomplishment, and they don't understand that, you know, I'm going to take a rest today. They are hyper, and in fact, you know, one of the problems is that they get bored when they're not challenged all the time, or Mr. Murphy, as I use all the time, is playing with them. So they're intense animals that thrive on being challenged, and when they're not challenged, that's when they probably get in a little bit of trouble.
So once again, as you can see, all the things that he's talking about, these particular attributes, have nothing to do with whether or not you have a soul or not. I mean, anyone can be an innovative person or independent thinker, even though I put that somewhat in question, because he defines independent thinking within a narrow sphere. But their whole overall goal is mission accomplished, you know, and they strive for this particular goal. Well, but what does that have to do with having a principle? And what are your principles? If your principles are basically to serve a particular machinery, then what's the difference between you or a Zionist Mossad agent or a Nazi or one of these killers chopping up and raping black women in the Sudan for the cartoon government, the NIF? What's the difference? Now, he talks about how many of the younger SEALs would become more attracted, in a sense, to what the line of work that he does, and talks about how, you know, they go through all of this training as a Navy SEAL for 6 months and all of that, and then they want to go out in the field and test their mettle. But then they have a field commander who doesn't want to turn them loose. So a frustrated young Turk, you know, sees him coming in as a mercenary with blood all over his hands, basically, and says, yeah, that's what I want to do. But what does that have to do with justice? So this is what I mean about when he talks about independent thinking. He's just talking about someone who can think of survival tactics on their feet while they're in occupied territories. Well, you had some Tiger Force guys in Vietnam who were somewhat independent thinkers. They were still killers. They're still barbarians. So once again, the whole machinery apparatus that perpetuates this institution is based around not having any kind of soul. Nothing that this clown can defecate out can outline anyone with any real human principles. He's just going to throw out the cliches of empire and run with it, because he loves killing, basically. Now, here Mancino goes into why he was a Navy salesman for all of these years. You know, because he's from the Nam generation. And now that he is a mercenary. So basically, why a lifetime of killing in the name of the corporate ruling order? Let's check him out.
Why did I do it? Because I was having fun. It certainly is enjoyable. You know, it's a... And it's not just the individual, but the atmosphere of the team, that, you know, the always pulling together, always learning together, always challenging together.
What about the killing? What about, you know, killing other people? What did you make of that?
It was just a job. It's a common question. I don't consider myself a killer. I'm a survivor. You know, what was the mission? What was I supposed to do on that mission? And that's what you do. If killing somebody that maybe could have talked or that shot at me, that was stopping me from completing my mission, then that was just my job. I don't have loss of sleep, and I don't have bad dreams, and I've never had them.
Hmm. Well, what I'm trying to square here, I mean, this is all very interesting, because on the one hand, you're saying war is just a brutal, nasty business. You've got to get the other guy before he gets you. It's, you know, it's just all a matter of survival. And, you know, on the other hand, there is something kind of romantic about this, isn't there? I mean, if you've got the right mindset, if you are a warrior at heart, it's kind of thrilling being out there.
Well, you know, I would say that the people that work with me all through the years, they're in their upper 40s, 50s, 60s. And they're still going back as contractors because they don't want to miss a war. And it's, I don't think we can say it on the show, but it's like the old bull and the young bull. You can get a young warrior that has the strength and the enthusiasm to go, but then you need that old warrior that is target selection, knows how to survive, knows how to pace themselves, so that, you know, that they're going to be there, because they know that once somebody finds out that you're around and doing the dirty deed, that they're going to come and get you. And so it's not that flash in the pan sprint, you know, you're there for the haul.
Now, you said that mercenaries basically are working outside the usual rules of the U.S. military. Are there any international laws that govern the activities of mercenaries?
I guess there's waivers in the back of the book, so I can't tell. I'm sure that there are United Nations rules and post-government rules on human rights issues and basic killing and pilfering and that, but, you know, who's out there to catch you?
I came across a quote from General Patton, who wrote in his diary, April 15th, 1943, "War is very simple, direct, ruthless. It takes simple, direct, and ruthless men to wage war." Do you think he was right? And does that describe you in a way?
Yeah, I don't think that I'm ruthless. I think that I am, I'll use that term again, focused. And I certainly do take direct action. I don't hold a staff study to figure out whether I should or I shouldn't. I mean, I do things, and that's the difference. And I think if you say that's ruthless, I don't think it's ruthless.
No, you're just soulless. But there you have it once again, where he's basically, where he's saying, killing is just a job. I'm just doing my job. I'm not a killer. I'm just doing my job. I don't consider myself a killer. You know, like he's playing some video game. And then he talks about how these old cats in their late 40s, 50s, and 60s are still going back because they don't want to miss a war. Like himself. So war gives them meaning. And not life and what it has to offer. Not true human equality, not the various joys, sexual and otherwise, of life. War. That's what it comes down to for these slobs. That's a person without a soul. That's a machinery within a society that has deprived people from even looking at what life has to offer, to even contemplate striving for it. But for him, the whole mercenary life, the Navy SEAL life, He's doing it because it's fun. Killing for fun. It never ends. And then when he's asked about, you know, international laws governing mercenaries, we know all there's types of international laws and Geneva Conventions and all of that. But for the mercenary, which he's right, because he's just a soulless dog with a machine gun for the Imperial Order, his comment is, who's going to catch you?
Chinese.
So the rules didn't change like he tried to say in the beginning. With the whole aspect of the war on terrorism and the various forces fighting without flags and all of that. This is just part of the machinery in their game that has never had principles. And their rules are based in conquest.
That was delicious.
By any and all means. And crushing over humanity is what they're about and know all too well. Hold on a sec.
My name is Captain Dan Hansen. I was deployed with the 724 Engineer Battalion, and I was the heavy equipment platoon leader in the engineering company.
I'm Josephine Jerome. I was a lieutenant when I deployed with the 229th Engineer Company out of Prairie du Chien and served as a platoon leader for a heavy equipment platoon.
My name is James Sandomirsky. I was a brigade intelligence officer with the 264th Engineer Group for OIF 2.
I'm Lieutenant Shannon Kilcoyne, and I deployed with the 264th Engineer Group of Chippewa Falls. And as I was deployed, I was a platoon leader for a combat heavy engineer battalion.
Hi, my name is Staff Sergeant Brian Worthing. I was a convoy escort squad leader with the 1158th Trans Company. First thing that I missed about being over there was the fact that over here, cars don't get out of my way. Over there, everyone moved for me.
Anything that I could miss over there is back home with me, and that's pretty cool.
Absolutely nothing. I brought everything with me, and it was here waiting for me.
I miss the everyday gratefulness for my life.
I think I miss the consideration from person to person. You know, we have a hard time back here getting along in an office space, and yet we could sleep that many people in one area and work together day in and day out and still get along.
After being home for just about a year now, I really miss the simplicity of life in a combat zone. Ultimately, our mission over there was simple. Get up in the morning, get your job done, no matter what it entailed, and get home safely.
The things I missed were fairly simple. The weather was warm, ammo was free, and I was finally doing the work that I'd spent over 14 years as a National Guardsman training to do.
I felt like I was doing something globally and historically important, and I've never had a greater sense of purpose in my life.
It was simple for these soulless souls. Get up early in the morning, get your job done, get home safely. Never mind the fact that the job is to extend and maintain global hierarchical dominance by a ruling elite that has genocidal vision on the planet today. Just get your job done. Do as you're told. These are just some of the lost souls of a militarized empire. An empire, like many other privatized hierarchical societies, that the slaves cannot coincide with. But that's the next chapter we must write. Until the next time. Slave out.